Well, good morning and good late afternoon on Tuesday, February 7th, 2012. You're listening to Brian and Gabe. And
where's it late afternoon?
It's late afternoon in Europe. Or is it actually evening?
I believe they call that night.
Okay, so it's night and it's mid-afternoon. Okay,
evening.
Well, there's got to be an island somewhere between New York and France.
In the Azores.
Yeah, there you go. In the Azores. Yeah. Good job, Jack.
Man.
Jack is now a geography guy.
with geography beats. So, this week, it's just the three of us this week to sort of discuss everything we skipped last week. And, you know, we're first now with our new time slot, which for me being on the West Coast is much, much better than how it was before.
I feel marginally more alert.
I'll tell you what, I was used to doing this at 10 o'clock in the morning, my time, you know, central time. And when we did that Peter Bloom cast when I was in San Francisco, that sucks, man. I can't believe that we've been doing it like this this whole time.
Right,
so
we've been telling you that.
I'm 100% behind this.
So I figure what we could kind of do is we've been writing about a lot of stuff the past few weeks. One of the things that we did, and I don't know if anyone noticed since, I guess it was like our New Year's resolution, we started having a sort of regular writing schedule.
The third week of the year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, did we only start a few weeks ago? I can't remember.
Oh, yeah. We phoned it in the first couple.
Bottom line is we're writing stuff every day. And so that means that it's definitely, I mean, yeah. Because before I know we were writing a few things here and there, but writing stuff every day is it's good for traffic, I guess. And there's lots to talk about. And we have an actual editorial calendar and everything now. So
it's good when there's a lot to talk about. We'll see what happens, you know, come July when when things are a little lean.
Well, we've still got a couple hundred posts in the list of, you know, sort of ideas to write about. So,
yeah.
But that also means, you know, when we do these shows 1 week apart, when we go back and look at the stuff from the last week, there's actually a lot of articles we did in the last week that we can talk about.
We should share that list someday with the community just so they can see what's on there. Because some of that stuff is like 5 years old. I swear to God, there's something in there about bear paw. I mean, there's some really ancient stuff.
Let's make a survey. Justin, take that as an action item to make a survey of the 200 items we have on our list to talk about. So let's just kind of look at what we were talking about this week. And I guess we can sort of start off. We'll start with Sean's article. So I think a lot of people know that Sean, well, probably everyone knows Sean Bass. He's 9-time Bri Forum speaker. He is still teaching the independent training classes that we sort of did back before we joined Tech Targets. Yeah. Sean was teaching those classes back then, and he's still doing that. And consulting, Citrix, CTP, Microsoft MVP, et cetera. And he started blogging for us this year. So I think the first two blog posts he did, his first one did like 4,000 views in the first day, which I don't think I've ever had a blog post that did 4,000 views in the first day. So his blogs have been really, really popular. He's done two posts so far.
He writes like he speaks. There's as many words crammed into a Sean Bass article as there are in a presentation, I think. But they're all awesome, which is just like a Sean Bass presentation.
We were joking because his first article was like 4,000 words long, which is about twice as long as typical articles that I write.
It's one word per page.
Twice long is my average, my maximum. But the thing is with Sean is he, you know, so the article is really long on paper, but if you listen to how fast that guy talks, like, hey, my article's 10 minutes, his article's 10 minutes. It's just that his has twice as many words in the thing.
You should use a smaller font.
So Sean's article this week was why thin clients and zero clients have not lived up to the last PC you'll ever buy hype. And the one thing that I read in this article that he sort of pointed out, I mean, you know, there's all the hype about the power consumption, mean time between failure and all that kind of stuff. But one thing I didn't really think about, which I think I liked that he pointed out, was that Linux thin clients are the cheap ones, but the experience on Linux thin clients is really poor also. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people to get the real, like if you want the best RDP and best like HGX experience, then you have to have a Windows thin client. And like, so he got into the media remoting and how the GDI primitives remoting and how, you know, you can send like GDI primitive to Windows clients, but if they're not Windows clients, then you have to send like the whole rasterized image, which is going to lead to worse performance. And that I mean, I feel like that these are good points, you know, and because if you're having Windows on your thin client, now we're getting into the whole thing we talked about before, which is you've got thin clients that are, you know, you've got to add them to the domain and have, you know, antivirus on them and security patches and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, can you guys hear me all right? Because I can barely hear you, but if you can hear me, I can weigh in on stuff.
Yeah, no problem. I think we can, Justin can up the volume we send to you.
No. It's not a volume thing. It's a crappy Skype thing.
Oh, right.
Well, we can hear you just fine.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. What he mentions in there is that, you know, that thin clients aren't future-proof. And so you mentioned the mean time between failure and all of that really holds true. You know, the thin client you bought 10 years ago probably still works today, but it probably hasn't kept up with the times. I mean, if you're still using the same solution you bought 10 years ago when you bought that thin client, have at it. I'm sure that thing is just peachy for you. But you've probably upgraded your platform. Your users and their requirements have probably grown as time goes by. You probably need to do all sorts of extra, you know, multimedia redirection and things like that the clients just weren't designed for back then. So expecting a thin client when you buy it to last for 7 years or even 5 years, really, let alone 9 or 10, is just kind of crazy unless you don't ever plan on upgrading your environment that you're actually accessing. So. And I think in there he says that they have about the same lifespan as a PC, maybe an extra year or so, but that's about all you can expect to get out of it.
That's true, because like at a bare minimum, like the ports and just the fact that, yeah, that thing client that I had 5 years ago still works great, but
yeah, right. Did our first Win Terms ever, did they even have USB ports?
Right, they did not. And like, right, it's got one display and it's VGA. So, I mean, yeah. I can display one VGA awesome right now in the thin client just as well as, but, you know, we don't know. Although the new thin clients like have like USB 3 and so that, which I think they almost do on purpose just so they can make a shorter lifespan.
Yeah, and then 4 years from now when USB 4 is out and these, while they may still be functioning, they won't have USB 4 and, you know, whatever new cool stuff comes out.
And this is why I wasn't mad when your cousin got drunk at a party that we had and peed all over my Win Term, because it was already obsolete anyway. So yeah. I didn't get mad that he destroyed it.
And right. by the way, that one, first of all, the story is true. Secondly, it was one of the ones, remember, it was integrated. So it was the CRT.
It was the all-in-one,
like,
yeah.
The glass CRT monitor that had a thin client built into it.
But you could actually, it had thumb screws on it. So you could unscrew and pull up the thin client part and replace that alone if the thin client part went bad. So you didn't have to get a whole new all-in-one unit.
So it wasn't really all-in-one. It's like, might as well been two zip ties. And because the thing is, there's so much room inside these things, you know? Like the CRT, the whole back is just like protecting like the ion gun or whatever. So why not just like, you know, you could fit a full computer inside a CRT. You don't need to limit it to just a thing.
I think that's called an iMac.
Yeah, really. I think that's true. I think that the WinTerm standalone terminals that you could buy also had the same. You could actually pull those guts out and put them into that all-in-one.
See,
if
they just had clear frames, clear shells in those days, and showed the insides instead of. They had thin clients built into keyboards back in the day too. So like your keyboard had a VGA port on it.
and now they're built into wall outlets and all. Yeah. So we've just been building thin clients into things for 15 years. That's their motto.
The people out there listening can't see that during the last 5 minutes of this conversation about crazy thin clients, I've been leaning back from the microphone and just cracking up.
You're allowed to crack up on the microphone. Hey, but they can see because we have a camera. So we're trying something new. It's not, we're not doing live streaming because I don't trust, our company told us we had 100 megabits of bandwidth, but I think that's hogwash. But we are recording ourselves and we'll pop that into YouTube. So we'll see if, I don't know if there's any value in looking at us about this kind of stuff. You can
probably not. So I'm so used to not being looked at now for these radio shows. I mean, who knows? You know, I promise that I don't make a habit of picking my nose, even if it looks like I do, because I'm on the side here. So
so if you use the video, you would see that I was Googling EMC VF cache. So one of the guests in the chat room asked, EMC VF cache versus Nutanix. What are your thoughts? And my first thought was I should Google and find out what EMC VF cache is.
Can we actually see your screen in the video?
No, but you can definitely see me leaning away from the microphone and looking at the chat screen and then looking at my screen.
See, when I look at the chat screen, I look directly at the camera. So it's creepy. I'm watching you.
So the good news, though, is that, okay, so I found this EMC VF cache thing. And to the person who wrote this, if this, you know, I read the article. It's actually a search solidstatestorage.techtarget.com. I didn't even know we had that site. I think we're getting a little ridiculous with the amount of like
a little too specialized
segmentation we have in these websites. Yeah. Search Zen client solid state on HP.techtarget.com. Oh, there's a pop-up banner. What do you know? So, and so it appears that this EMC VF cache thing is just solid state storage, like, because it talks about them competing against Fusion IO, and Fusion IO, you know, is basically like super fast, you know, as close to unlimited IOPS as you can that you pop into, you know, an existing machine or whatever. And so if that's the case, then this is kind of an apples and oranges things with Nutanix, because Nutanix, their whole thing is like, yes, they are using solid state storage, but they're really more about creating that, like a grid. So the Nutanix blade, it's not really a blade, but call it something like that, has processor and storage and everything in together, and you pop it into your enclosure, and then all of them kind of use all of each other. So it's like RAID, but amongst servers and storage everywhere. So all the blocks that are written are written all over the place across all the multiple different nodes in the thing. So if that's the case, it's kind of an apples and oranges different a little bit, because VF cache is just super fast local storage. But Nutanix uses Fusion IO actually for their super fast storage. But Nutanix is not just appliances with super fast storage. Nutanix is actually changing the way storage works, and you don't have a SAN, it replaces a SAN. Every Nutanix node you plug in, it sort of grows the storage across it. As a matter of fact, I just got an email last night about...
You know what? So VF cache looks like it goes to the server level. So you know how, who's it, Xiotech that has the flash storage and then the disk storage and can intelligently put them higher demanded stuff in the flash or in the SSD. It looks like EMC has the same kind of thing, except now this is taking that down to the server level. So instead of that efficiency residing in your storage system, it's residing inside your servers on local disk now.
So maybe that is like Nutanix then.
Well, but then you already said the grid architecture and things like that go into it as well. So if the grid architecture doesn't exist, then it's still probably not like Nutanix. And in this case, is that it's more of a competitor to Fusion IO, is
right?
What I would guess.
Yeah. So speaking of Nutanix, though, it's timely because we went down there. Oh, I don't know what last year. Were you here yet, Jack? I don't even know.
No.
And they were talking about they were going to be doing a big test with like 50 nodes, thousands of desktops, just to really stress test and find out what this thing could actually do. And they are done with that. So they were using that VMware Rock tool. Remember RAWC, that thing that Fred Scrimshiner, is that his name? Scrimshiner?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, but...
The dude who made that thing up for VMware was at Briform. He presented it last year.
Shimshimer?
Something like that. Sorry, bro. We thought what you spoke about was awesome. But so they use VMware Rock, they're talking about they found some interesting design limits. Like they finally found some design limits, not just in their hardware, but in the way the whole architectures of desktop virtualization works, because they're able to give, again, sort of close to unlimited bandwidth and IOPS and processing. But they also found some limits in their products too. So, they're presenting also VMware Partner Exchange next week. But we're gonna actually get down there this week and sort of get pre-briefed from them. So once they release this information to the partners next week, hopefully we can have a little bit of the inside story. So I'm going to do so I'll ask them, by the way, about the VF cache. And we have another on the chat. It says VF cache is being positioned with other EMC products to offer the blended disk solution. So yeah, so that's blended disk. It sounds like that is sort of a storage level thing, like that Xiotech stuff that you were mentioning before.
There's another comment in there. VFC1234 gives us an update that says it's being positioned with other EMC products to offer a blended disk solution. But our anonymous users are called Anon and then four digits. So VFC, I wonder if this is a VFC cache person that's actually listening.
Right. Like they changed their name and they're now called.
Yeah.
Yeah. VFC cache fan 101. Well, so
there's six people here, two of them.
So, thank you for listening regardless. We have, so this we'll talk to Nutanix and I guess, find someone at EMC. I don't think we really talked to, I don't know anyone at EMC. I don't think. Do you, Gabe?
No. No, I don't think I do.
Yeah, I'm pretty good with NetApps, iOTech, all these startups, HP for storage, Dell. But yeah, I don't think I know any EMC people. So if any EMC people are listening, shoot me a line. Brian@BrianMadden.com. And let's talk about it. So moving on, let's kind of look at some of the other stuff that we talked about this past week. Gabe, you wrote about OnLive, and you wrote this article called like the OnLive Loose Ends, where remind us of OnLive and then what are these loose ends?
Yeah, I mean, it was a follow-up, and I don't think that we talked last week about the first OnLive article that I wrote that kind of breaks down OnLive Desktop. OnLive Desktop, if you haven't heard about it yet, it was kind of all the rage at CES, except they didn't even have a booth there. They just announced it during CES and had some people at the show, right, Jack?
Yeah, no booth.
Right. So still though, it got a lot of press during and around CES, and they released it during then. It's a desktops as a service solution, but it's aimed at the same. It's aimed at consumers right now, not at businesses. OnLive is known for their gaming, their cloud-based gaming solution, where they send you basically a thin client, that and a controller. And you can use that to stream games down to you from the cloud. It's and it actually works really well if you have a wicked connection.
But when you say stream, it's like server-based computing games. It's not actually putting the game onto your device and running locally.
You're right. I mean stream more like you're watching a movie, streaming a video across. Except they've enhance that even more, because they not only do you have to watch this, but you also have to be able to interact with it in real time. So you're right, it is more like a remoting protocol that we talk about, you know, every day in our normal lives. But that's not how they refer to it or pitch it to, you know, the consumers that they're talking to.
Right, because consumers don't know what the hell a thin client, because they're like, oh, it's just a remote desktop, but for games. But yeah,
right.
Their world streaming. All right, anyway.
And it does go beyond that. I mean, the challenges that they have, you know, we have enough issues alone remoting a YouTube video to people. So, so if they're talking about 720p video and things like that, I mean, they do a pretty good job, especially with the real-time back-and-forth data or the data that they have to send. Now, it requires a lot of bandwidth. So, and so we're both quick to jump on it and say, well, Citrix and VMware would do just fine too if you gave them 7 megs of bandwidth.
Yeah, because they're the ones that said that this is the thing where the OnLive guy is saying, like, look how much better we are than Citrix. And then you read the requirements, and for 720p video, they require 5 megabits. And I'm like, wait a minute. So 720p, that's not even like desktops are higher than that. Desktops are like higher than 1080p even. They're like 1900 by 1200, and we care about every pixel. None of this like JPEG, oh, just like guess what those letters are over there and mash them together. So,
yeah, exactly.
And we could, and Citrix, VMware, Microsoft, we could deliver the shit out of an experience if we had 5 megabits also, you know?
Yeah, right. Let's do remote effects all the time.
Yeah, done. Verizon and Comcast and all them would love you to do that too.
Well, and so that's actually part of how they work. So Jack managed to score contact with them, and when I was in San Francisco a few weeks ago, we actually went down to Palo Alto and talked to him. We talked to their CEO, Steve Perlman. Before we even got into the meeting with this guy, we were told all about his virtues. You know, he was on the team that invented QuickTime, or invented the technology that became QuickTime. He started Web TV and then sold it to Microsoft. Started the company that created the animation techniques that won an Academy Award for Benjamin Button and all sorts of stuff. So this guy's got a track record.
But Gabe, I'll add that we only learned about this track record about 5 minutes before our meeting, so we didn't have time to process it. So we just sort of went in thinking that he was, you know, some guy.
Yeah, I mean, you know. It's
and then afterwards, it's like, oh, wait a second.
Like, wow, that dude fucking invented QuickTime, man. That's pretty cool. But still, like, I don't know. I mean, we talked to a lot of people, so it's for me, it's I don't get starstruck that easily. But that guy was cool, and it would have been cool to, like, you know, bullshit with him about that kind of thing. But he probably has that happen all the time. But either way, so we went in there, and we were armed with a lot of questions. We want to know how it works. What's the back-end broker? Are you using virtualization? What's the protocol? But specifically, we wanted to learn, how the hell is this licensed? I mean, they're giving away Windows desktops with Microsoft Office for free. And so we want to know how they're licensing it, because it's a cloud-based solution delivering Windows 7 to random people. And we know from talking to these other DAS solutions out there, like TwoCloud and DingCloud Destone. Yeah, and these guys that we know from talking to them that that is a very hard thing to do from a Microsoft licensing standpoint. Technically speaking, it's solved, but licensing, Microsoft makes it hard because they don't have a service provider license for Windows 7.
So this is, as a service provider, you can provide terminal server desktops, you can provide Office, but if you're a service provider providing Windows 7 desktops, there's no service provider licensing, so the company you're providing desktops to, they have to own the licenses.
Correct.
Which is why a Destone or TwoCloud can do it, because they're working to commercial customers, but if they're opening the whole world, like how does OnLive say, hey, here's your Windows desktop, now don't use this unless you bought your own, you know, little SA.
Right. Well, and Destone and TwoCloud and those guys, they have to keep each organization's desktops on dedicated hardware as well. So here's your set of hosts that this is for this company, and here's another set of hosts dedicated to another company. And so they don't get to, you know, if you have five hosts and you use 100% of four of them and 5% of the fifth one, you don't, that other 95% is wasted. They can't use that to service another customer of theirs. There's all sorts of intricacies. It's easy enough to work around, but Microsoft can make it easier.
I was going to say, for those listening now to this, what Gabe was talking about, we'll revisit this in the Why Brian Hates Microsoft segment of the show later.
Which is coming, yeah. I give it 7 minutes. So we go in there, we're armed with these questions. We were trying to be cool about it. We weren't trying to be like investigative beat reporters, that kind of a thing. But, we're
just bloggers, not real journalists here, just to be clear.
Gabe Knuth investigates.
Yeah, we are whatever it took to get us into the meeting. But we sit down and I explain where we come from and what the things are that we think about. And he just launches into the demo that we've seen a bunch of times overall, which was showing us how games work, showing us how we can shadow games, things like that. And again, we saw this demo. And when he goes into the Windows desktop world, he shows us how, you know, look, I can do this. It's on my iPad. Look, it's Windows, that kind of a thing. And I stopped and I'm like, look, we saw this demo in 1999. Like, this is, we get this concept. We're fine there. But I want to know is how, you know, is there an instance of Windows running? Is it virtual? You know, what we want to know, what people are asking me is, how is this licensed? And he kept deferring to the point he actually said at one point that he wasn't trying to be evasive. They just had it covered. They had a team of licensing guys. They're in compliance, and that's not the important thing. The really hard stuff is the how cool this experience is, or something to that effect. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
who may or may not be doing illegal things.
Who was that? Art Matrano, the magician that would do the crazy magic YouTube for Art Matrano. He was the guy that could make it look like he pulled his thumb apart, or he would put his hands together in a ring and then pull them apart like they were those metal rings in real life. It was just kind of like stage magic, really bad stage magic. Either way, though, so this went on for quite a while, and I feel like I was kind of a dick, I wouldn't let up. I'm like, come on, you have to tell us, like, how is this stuff licensed? Like, there has to be, I mean, you have to know this. This is something that a company, to put out this solution, you would have to get this. And if he knows, he didn't let on, and I think he just doesn't know. I'm not saying nobody knows at OnLive. I'm just saying, you know, I believe that he does not know how it's licensed. So that was kind of a disappointing thing to come out of there with. And that was the crux of the article that I wrote, breaking down the solution. I explained how it works. I explained how, you know, they get such good performance with the games because they do this JPEG kind of compression. When they can't keep up their UDP stream, since the game is moving all the time, they can compress that visually. And it doesn't really have any effect on you as the gamer because the screen's moving around the entire time. They also guarantee, or they hedge their bets really with as far as the data connection goes, to make sure that there's as few hops as possible by doing what they call peering with all the major ISPs in the country. So that way, my connection to their servers has as few hops as possible, rather than just going through the public internet. I mean, it's still the public internet, but rather than just trying your luck and hoping you get a good connection every time, they've gone to great lengths to ensure that you get the best possible one.
And that's why there's no OnLive Australia or OnLive in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and right, and there is OnLive in Europe and things like that. And as they roll that out, that's fine. But yeah, that's right. That's why you can't fire up a, you can't take your video game thin client with you to India and play. Excuse me. So we learned about some of the technical things of OnLive. We learned about how they're able to deliver the games and to deliver them well. But we also learned that they are very hung up on the fact that they feel that the games are the hardest thing in the world to remote. And so desktop should be no problem. And so if they can remote 720p, high def, they call it video games, which, as we learned, since if the connection suffers, then it just starts to compress that image. So if they can deliver these games, they think that they can deliver the desktops too. And the overall experience is fine if your connection is perfect, just like every other remote protocol out there. But once you start to introduce a little bit of latency or a little bit of packet loss, then things start to go downhill pretty quick. And you see how, you remember Geek Week, how when we turned on the WAN emulator and it, all of a sudden it sort of exposed how these protocols worked.
Oh yeah. Cause it's kind of like running, it's like debugging in slow motion sort of.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how this is too. If I go stand exactly right next to my wireless access point down in the basement, it works just fine. Right. But if I get to the other side of my house and I have a perfectly ample wireless connection to do absolutely everything else in the world, but it's still not quite good enough for OnLive to use. And you can start to see it almost looks like VMware. It looks like PC over IP is built to lossless, where it comes in really crappy and then kind of looks a little bit better and better and better. And that's the indication of how the protocol works when it comes to games, because it just doesn't have to be perfect. You don't have to have a sharp line around a little letter B on your screen. But for me, as a desktop user, my windows have to be crisp. My words have to look good. I have to be able to navigate in real time and not sit there and wait for it.
And I can't fall down to standard def, which is like whatever 400 lines, which right. on a screen. So what's the monitor equivalent? Like, oh, we drop you down to 640x480, but don't worry, we stretch it and expand it back to fill up your 24-inch monitor.
Yeah,
I mean, what is that?
Yeah, it's I just don't think that they translate. It makes sense, right? In my head, I believe that going down there, I believe that, hell yeah, man, if they can do games, that's badass.
Yeah.
They should be able to do desktops, no problem. But it's about the protocol, and it's about how that works, how that translates to the desktop side. And like I said, I will fully give them, if you have a badass connection, if you've got 3 meg, 5 meg, no latency, that kind of a thing, you're doing it, it's just fine.
But again, so is vanilla RDP out of the box. That's also just fine on 3 megs with no latency.
Absolutely, yep. And then the other thing to note is that they show the iPad client. Right now it's only available as an iPad offering. The way there's no local keyboard, there's no local options for anything. So it exclusively uses the Windows 7 touch interface, which actually I don't know if anything else does that. Anything that we deal with day to day.
Yeah, those like HP computers you have in your kitchen. Although they come with keyboards and mice too, though.
But Citrix doesn't. You know, you couldn't. Zen Desktop doesn't have the Windows 7 touch interface, right? Like you can't.
Oh, I think remoting. Like you mean, like does it actually remote multi-touch versus just remoting the mouse emulation?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
I think you're right. So they remote multi-touch.
Yes, they have. You're right. So yeah. The demo was kind of cool.
OnLive remotes multi-touch.
OnLive. Yeah. That was kind of neat. You could pinch zoom and things like that. But again, it just the fact that you could do that was fine. But I missed having a local keyboard because, picture how much you hate typing in a virtual desktop with the native keyboard on your iPad. Now imagine doing that with the built-in Windows keyboard, waiting to send your tap to the key, yeah. having it come back to you. And in the meantime, your whole keyboard gets all screwed up because the connection dropped.
It's blurry. You have to wait. You have to wait for a round trip to work and like turn the button gray to even know you hit the right key.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you're
everybody
typing.
In the video just got to watch me hit my mute button, cough, and then turn it back on. So I coughed completely quietly.
That was advanced radio. But so you have, so you're three paragraphs into the thing before you realize that you missed a letter somewhere along the way.
No, you're not, because you're painfully aware that you're missing letters constantly. You're three letters in before you're like, fuck this. And
it comes out as F space C K / T / S.
Yeah. So, and they tell you, like, before they even hooked us up with the demo, they wanted to know if we had a Bluetooth keyboard, and I said yes, because I knew that was going to happen, and obviously, in Citrix, in VMware, and Oracle, and whatever, I would much rather have a Bluetooth keyboard to connect to this thing and to type into a iPad-based VDI or desktop session. So I knew that that was coming, but I wanted to see what the remote multi-touch experience was like, and it wasn't any better than anything else. I mean, it was cool that you could do it, but that's all.
So
that was all the first article, right? So that was all like breaking down OnLive. That spurred a whole lot of discussion about how they're doing desktops and the licensing behind that and so on. And you can imagine, you know, guys like Geese were from 2Cloud were very vocal in the conversation around that. And
all the real cloud desktop providers are like, are these guys like they have a secret private agreement with Microsoft, or are they just ignorantly breaking the license agreement? Or
well, right, and there's only so many options, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, you could be I went so far as to, I never actually said that they're breaking this, you know, because it's all speculation, right? So I don't want to say that they're knowingly.
But you can say I speculate that they're breaking license agreements.
Well, that's exactly what I said. So I mean, so that's one of the options, right? Yeah. So the one is they're blissfully unaware of it. Two is that they have something custom with Microsoft, or three, and this one was actually posited by I think Tal from Citrix, and then a few other people helped back it up, was that they could be using Blade PCs. If they were using Blade PCs, I learned that they're running Windows 7 Enterprise, by the way. Once I got in, I was able to poke around and see what was going on. So they could be using Blade PCs, which is dedicated hardware, and then remoting that to people. And if it's dedicated hardware, and then you can do whatever you want with it. And because we're not using, it's at that point, it's more like log me in.
Right. Yeah. And the thing is, so the, because someone was mentioning, you know, so OnLive also does with their games, their video game service, they offer access to Windows games. Mm-hmm. So, and Windows games presumably require a properly licensed copy of Windows. So presumably they either had an agreement with Microsoft that worked with those Windows games, or they were like you were saying, maybe they're using Blade workstations with a central image streaming to stream down the game or something like that. So presumably they already had some legal mechanism in place to deliver Windows games to people, so they could maybe leverage that for their Windows desktops.
My favorite is the big FU to Microsoft theory that they had this custom games thing worked out that was supposed to be just for games. Like, okay, this is fine. It's just going to be, you know, you're going to be running Windows like the kernel, but, you know, the games are just going to be there and it's just going to be access to games. And then OnLive finds a loophole and says, hey, we can do desktops too. Okay. And then starts putting the desktops out there, which I think is funny. I mean, who knows? I doubt that Microsoft would let that happen, but you never know.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's where the Loose Ends article comes into play. Somebody jumped in there and found a VMware folder in SQL program files. I jumped in and looked at it too. Unless they're doing some trickery to hide the files from us, that folder is empty. So my guess is that they just built the base image in VMware Workstation or something and then saved it, and that folder just is, you know, still there, a remnant.
Because there's no evidence of the agent, the VMware desktop agent or anything like that
there. I can't find anything, yeah. Right. So, and that's not to say they're not there, but, you know, skin deep, it doesn't look like they're doing that. Yeah. So, I mean, they could be, but... and then, so I went on, like, you know, I mean, so are they using VMware? Are they using dedicated hardware, custom licensing? Those are all boring. So I thought, you know, I wonder, so somebody actually pointed this out to me on Twitter, so I didn't just make it up out of thin air, but somebody wondered if they were an acquisition target. And so I got to thinking, I wonder who the hell would buy them. And then I remembered this article that you wrote, I don't know, 18 months ago, something like that, where you were, maybe it was 2 years ago, you were talking with Benny about the whole point of remote effects.
Yeah.
And Benny suggested, he's like, dude, this isn't about, you know, remote protocols for, you know, local desk or for desktops in your organization. This is about serving Windows from the cloud. And then it went on to become, this is about Xbox from the cloud too. I mean, think of where this could go, and this could go to Xbox from the cloud as well. And so then I think, all right, so we got games from the cloud, desktops from the cloud, all via this protocol that really works well when you got a bunch of when you got a bunch of bandwidth.
By a guy who's built and sold companies
to Microsoft
and Apple and these big enterprise IT companies. Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, I feel like it's a little bit more qualified than a crazy ass suggestion, but, you know, because it's not completely off the wall. But other than that, like, I mean, all I did was put these pieces together and kind of make this up. So, but I feel like, I mean, it could happen.
It's one tick away from,
crazy
crackpot theory.
Yeah, but the thing is, but that's but but protected though.
Right, this is the kind of thing you hang your hat on. Because in 6 months, when this happens, guess who got it? You know.
Yeah, that's right. So we don't know any closer. I mean, we're no closer though to knowing what the hell they're doing. Like we still to this day don't know.
No,
how the hardware is. We don't know how they're licensed.
Shall we push the begin rant button? Because you, Brian's an MVP, so we're like, all right,
no,
let's see. Maybe
Brian is the unwilling MVP. So first of all, so I have been a Microsoft MVP since 2003, and you know that's well, I won't get into what the program is, but you know, I feel like back in the day it used to matter. Now, granted, you know, now when I was an MVP, when I joined
old
the MVP,
man Brian here.
No, hang on. When I joined the MVP program, I was like, I joined along with a bunch of other people in the for Terminal Server MVP. So I think like in the year that I joined in, like that was Benny's year, who else was in there? There's a bunch of people, and before me, the only MVPs were like Claudio was an MVP before me. And I think that was maybe it. There's like two Terminal Server MVPs, and even they were like, "Oh, this program's going to hell," because now they're like,
it was probably like Vera or something.
Eight people, yeah. Who I've never met in person, by the way. But she is, she's in Sweden, I think, and just answers questions on Microsoft boards all day, and that's her thing. I'll talk to her via email. She's very lovely, but does not want to go out in public. Or does not want to go to these events because she says, "Oh, I just handle the easy questions," but which maybe is true. She just does like 100 a day, and so
yeah, and she's amazing at it.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and if you're out there, we have always Bryform. Anytime you want to come, it's on us. So, take it anytime you want. I don't know, you know, but I feel like it was more personalized attention they gave us. I don't know. We have this, like, the MVP contact, you know, like your liaison into Microsoft has been like, it's, you know, it was one person for a long time, then another person for a long time. And then recently it's gotten like every 6 months, there's a new person. They don't know who you are. And they each have like, you know, 100 MVPs to deal with. And they used to give us stuff of value like MSDN subscriptions. So at least we got all the software from Microsoft free, but they don't do that anymore. They used to give us email addresses, actually internal Microsoft.com email addresses. So you could be like on the Exchange server at Microsoft and you could really interact with the product team directly and like look them up in the GAL and that kind of stuff. But that's all, they don't do that anymore. And the timing, they have this MVP conference where everyone gets together for like 2 or 3 days, but it's always in the beginning of March. But unfortunately, the beginning of March doesn't always like sync up very well with where they're going to be making announcements because the Microsoft product cycle is so slow. So like even going to that thing is like pretty freaking worthless. It's just like parties. It's just a junket, you know, like you go to Seattle and like have parties at the, I don't know, Children's Museum or the Rockin' something. I don't know. It's just a big giant party, you know, and it's just. And then you go in the rooms with your people, and it's all like this NDA stuff about the future that they're like so far in the future, and they like ask you what your opinions are. And guess what? The same thing always happens. Like, oh, licensing sucks, and it's just I don't know.
We can't write anything about it then, and that becomes in a way is a liability because I write under and I am also part of NDAs. Not I don't think with Microsoft, but with other companies, and it's hard because if you get NDA information. You really can't speculate on what they might do with things because if you were told that and then you break NDA somehow by accident, like it's a liability.
Yeah. So we backed off from NDAs. So we don't do NDAs really anymore. And unless it's a very specific thing. So like
short term too.
Well, yeah. So there's a difference between NDA and embargo. So embargo is just like, let me tell you about this news this week. We're not announcing until next week, so don't tell anyone about it, but you can, you know, have your article ready to go. I'm fine with that. But this long-term stuff, and I'm also not saying that NDAs are worthless. Like, if I was an end-user customer and I was, like, buying into, in a big way, VMware or Citrix, I would want to get their, like, NDA roadmap for where they're going in the next year so I can make decisions about what products I'm buying. But for our role, like, where our jobs are just to write and comment about stuff, these NDAs don't really... you're right. Yeah. They don't help us. They hurt us because we're in a room all day hearing about all these features, and then we can't. But the vendors, all the vendors, it's really changed. Like Citrix used to be very open with what they tell us under NDA. And then as soon as VMware, but that's all on XenApp and, you know, MetaFrame. But then as soon as VMware Vue came out, Citrix started really clamping down and doesn't tell us anything because they're afraid that we're on the take from VMware and just going to go leak it back to VMware. And VMware doesn't tell anything because they think we're all in bed with Citrix because Citrix was there first. And, you know, Microsoft, everything is NDA. And like, it's just, so, you know, so the program became like, you don't get MSDN. They don't know who the hell I am anymore. You don't get the email addresses in there. NDAs are kind of worthless. I actually didn't even apply to the program this year because what happens is every year, the MVP program, it's like a reward for the work you did in years past. So it's like they look at for people who are members of the community and post blogs and do events and speaking and that kind of stuff. But I didn't even, you're supposed to apply to it every year and send them like an update of what you did. But I didn't even do that this year because just thinking I would drop out. But like they still made me an MVP again. So I'm now an unwilling, I didn't sign the, like they gave me all the MVP and all that, but I didn't sign that again. They sent me the trophy. Actually, can one of you grab that trophy off of Jack's desk? Let me show you this thing. So even the prizes, like they used to, you know, give you like this trophy every year, but then now they stopped doing, they give you like one big trophy and then you have like these little rings that you plug on each year. That's like, you got like, so my MVP kit this year was my lapel pin and my, you know, my trophy ring. That's like 2012 on it or whatever.
Do you have any plans to wear anything with a lapel this year?
I don't think you need to write the word I don't think you need to put the word this year onto that statement.
Well, sometimes you have a meeting, like you met with like Parliament or something last year. Yeah. You had to wear a suit to that.
Fuck,
you
know? Man, I should have worn my MVP thing to this.
So you tried to use your mic.
Here's this thing. Thank you, Justin. So here's my MVP award. And the funniest thing too is like apparently they started this in the year 2010 because there's like 2010, 11, and 12 discs that plug into this little trophy. You could kill someone with this thing. This is heavy. But people complain because they're MVPs for like many, many years. So if you're an MVP for before, they sent us later like a 5-year disc. You can like put it on the bottom to show you're an MVP like at least the past 5 years. But I was actually an MVP even before that. So like they owed me like an extra 1-year disc. But, you know, I don't know. It's just this is the value of being an MVP. And so the other value they say is like, well, look, man, it's not about like trophies. Actually, we can just put this. We're going to build some shelves in here next week. And there we go. The value is its background, so you don't have to look at this wooden wall the whole time. And they say that, well, but man, the value is you have a connection to Microsoft. Like, you can ask them questions, you can get questions answered, and, like, you know, ask them just it's a direct connection into Microsoft, and, you know, people find that valuable. Okay, fine. So I've been an MVP for, 8 years according to my trophy, but in real life, I think it's been like 9 to 10 years. And I don't believe that I've leveraged my access to Microsoft for fucking anything before until this OnLive. See what this brings back around to OnLive. So this OnLive thing happens, and the other cloud providers are basically saying, this is shady. The whole world is saying, like, is this shady? Is embedded together? How's it possible? So I email my contact at Microsoft to ask about, hey, OnLive, that's all the rage. It's been on the blogs and tweets. Like, what's happening with that? And they came back with like a pretty generic answer, which is like, of course, we cannot comment on, you know, any customers, what they might or may not be doing, because that's not really like, hey, you know, we're just the product group. Now, granted, this product group has desktop licensing experts in it, and these desktop licensing experts have been at the MVP meetings and always say, if you have any questions, send them over. We're happy to answer. And I'm asked a question, they're like, oh, we can't comment on this. I'm like, well, okay, so that was an empty promise, I guess, to begin with. So then
maybe
I'm like,
they can't specifically talk about customers.
So I rephrase my question, and I say, okay, new question. I want to create desktop as a service offering. I want to use Windows 7 Enterprise desktops. I want to deliver the desktops to customers, but to customers who are not, like, to end-user consumers. I want them to have a free desktop or a $10 a month desktop. I want to host it in my data center and deliver these to customers anywhere in the, you know, country, and I want them to be able to access it, and I don't want them to buy their own licenses. So how would I do that? And they were like, Brian, we cannot comment on what customers may or may not be doing. I said, no, stop. This has nothing to do with OnLive. I want forget OnLive. New topic, new thread. I want to do this. Please help me understand, Microsoft product people, how what I'm saying is possible to do. And I didn't hear back. So email them a few days later. I'm like, hello, can I hear an answer? And they're like, yeah, we're looking into this. We talked to our licensing people. Like, we'll get back to you. Fucking nothing from them. And so there's been like three or four emails back and forth with them. And so really, like, they don't have an MSDN. They don't have, you know, this access like to the internal emails and all this kind of stuff. And now on top of all that, I finally asked them a question that you would think is a simple question, and they can't even fucking tell me the answer. And so, like, what the hell value does this program have? You know, like, there's zero value in this program. And then that just rekindles the old anger I have at Microsoft, because, you know, I wrote an article like 6 months ago about how Microsoft is screwing the entire industry by purposefully making Windows 7 really hard to license. And I think, Gabe, in your OnLive article, someone wrote about this, like, someone wrote about like this in the comment, right? Where Microsoft is the ones that are holding back the desktop virtualization industry and desktops as a service from happening. Because the whole world, all these guys that are doing, like, you know, we talked to, like, you know, the Desktone and the Two Cloud people, and they're ready to go. The technology is ready to go for delivering Windows desktops from the cloud. And Microsoft is just absolutely, like, purposefully making that difficult to do, to, like, you know, support their shitty old ass freaking monopoly. So, like, the day that I stop using Microsoft products in general will be a very happy day for me. And I'm angry I still have to use Microsoft Office. I'm trying so hard to go 100% off of Microsoft. And I just fucking hate Microsoft. You can tweet me on that. Tweet quote me on that. I fucking hate Microsoft. That's bullshit. So I'm not going to the MVP thing. Like, fuck them and their MVP. I'm actually going to take this trophy and, like, figure out, like, will it blend? So I don't know if I...
I think this this proves that you are indeed App Detective.
No, when I said I fucking hate Microsoft, I spelled that right. We'll film a different YouTube video of me, like, destroying my trophy, and or, like, recycling it or whatever.
If you're gonna do it, I would mangle it and then put it back on the shelf.
Oh, that's amazing! Yeah, I'm gonna get a mask and a sledgehammer.
Put a jar of broken glass on the shelf.
It's just such bullshit because, like, you know, and what irks me the most about this whole thing is how, like, they always give this crap about how we love to listen to our customers. And, you know, like, which is such, it's like so patronizing, because every single MVP meeting I've been to for the past 3 or 4 years has been Microsoft desktop licensing, this VDI, VDA, VECD, SA, enterprise only, the rights. It's so messed up, so messed up, so messed up. And every single goddamn person Microsoft talked to is like, I know, I wish I could do something about it. But you know someone there in that back room can do something about it, but they're purposefully fucking their customers just so they can continue their monopoly to exist. And it's just such bullshit. And the thing is, like, obviously my whole job is related to, like, the Microsoft Windows desktop delivery industry. And so I recognize that we as an industry have, you know, 20 years of Microsoft applications legacy, you know, in front of us that we have to figure out how to deliver. So, like, I'm not all about, I mean, but Microsoft are doing this to themselves. Like, this is not, like, this is them specifically planning to screw customers just to protect their own revenue. And I guess that's what monopolies do. Like, Apple does the same thing. And I guess I don't hate Apple for the same reason, because they make cool products at least. So maybe I'm being what's that called? When the pot calls the kettle black, an asshole. I don't know. I don't know. But it's just, like, fuck that company. And so I don't know. I'm just not a fan of anything they're doing. With regard to this policy, I am a fan of other things they're doing, though, like remote effects in Windows 8. That's kind of badass. So congratulations to Microsoft, you made that awesome. Too bad we can't, you know, license it to use it. But so I'm ready to move on.
I want to give credit to Landon Fraley, who's the guy that made the comment about the acquisition. He actually suggested even calling it Microsoft, or going to Microsoft and calling it Xbox Online. So, but just, you know, in case Landon Fraley's watching, I got that idea from you. I was going through, there's so many more complicated things. The comments in this article are so great. Talking about how good the go-to my PC reasoning is only appropriate if I'm the primary user of the device I'm remotely connecting to, and if I'm not the primary user, I have to have the identical version of the edition that I'm accessing on my current device. And, like, it's just so messed up. And honest to God, Microsoft owes us an explanation here about how this works and about how OnLive can do something that other people are out there trying to build business models around, struggling with, trying to do, and how they can treat two different companies.
And when you say they owe us,
it might be legitimate. That's fine, but I want to know why. And I think they owe us as the
community.
Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, not us as
us three assholes.
Yeah,
like two assholes and Jack.
Tell all of them and forget about us. That's fine. We'll pick it up from somebody somewhere else. But but yeah, like I want the community as a whole to know this because it's not. I mean, if they're clearly not playing by the same rules that everybody else is online.
That is a true statement. OnLive is clearly not playing by the same rules. Can I use actual F-bombs in titles of articles? Like maybe I just always do F. F you Microsoft. Something shady is going. Something shady is going on with Microsoft, with OnLive. Microsoft knows the story. F them for not telling us. What's my next turn in the article rotation? Let me check my calendar here.
You want tomorrow? Yeah.
Wait. Do I have anything for tomorrow? Let me see.
Editorial. I've got tomorrow for BrianMadden.com.
You're on. We actually have CIT a spreadsheet tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm looking at my spreadsheet. Oh, I got Thursday. I'm a CIT tomorrow. Yeah, CIT is our little code for consumerized IT. Right. Okay. Look, moving on. Now, speaking of Microsoft, though, I feel like what Microsoft did for Remote FX in Windows 8 is kind of badass. So I want to talk about that for a little bit. Gabe, did you actually read this article that I wrote?
I'm actually looking for
Don't
it right
read it.
Now
well, I'll tell you right now. So it doesn't matter.
No, that's fine.
Look, so first of all, this article I wrote is basically it's based on Microsoft's Build conference, which was from like October or something like that. It was a long time ago. And I finally got around to watching it. So this is...
Oh, yeah. Build. I read this one. Okay.
Yeah.
Go on.
So basically, I want to look at what Microsoft are doing for RDP and for Remote FX in Windows 8. And the gist of it is that... So all the stuff is based on the stuff from Build. But first of all, it's clear that I think that Remote FX, so it seems like they're calling everything Remote FX now. So they don't have to, like, it's like Remote FX is essentially the new name for RDP, almost like HDX replaced. You don't have to watch, you can listen. And so it's like the, I feel like the name RDP is kind of going away. And they're calling everything Remote FX. But they're adding some cool capabilities. So one thing they're adding is some adaptive graphics. And the adaptive graphics are doing twofold. A, like we talked about, there's different types of compression and like lossy compression, build to lossless and everything. They're actually going to divide the screen into different areas and do different kinds of compression based on what they see, which I think like HDX does this now. So if they identify a text region, they're not going to build to lossless text. They're going to use a special codec that's good for encoding text.
Oh, what do you know? Because lossless compression on text sucks.
Yeah, yeah. And then if they recognize more graphical regions of the screen, they can do a build to lossless or lossy compression with like a high quality lossy where you can't
or
tell.
Motion, that kind of a thing. Yeah.
And then the motions are different. So motion's interesting because so for motion, they've always had the redirection of like direct show and like direct, you know, Win Fun Foundation video. They've always been able to do like actual multimedia redirection, you know, and just render that on the client.
Right.
But if they detect motion, they will actually use an H.264 video codec and encode that section of screen. But this is not doing
That's any motion. That's yes. Not that's moving a window around. That's not that's exactly how Oracle works that I'm writing about for tomorrow.
Oh, interesting.
Any motion on the screen, they call it, I forget, a randomly changing area or something like that. They any mass motion on the screen, they actually convert that to motion JPEG and send it down to the client, and the client has a motion JPEG decoder on it.
Oh, interesting. And then so with Remote FX, that's cool because this is happening like at the screen buffer level, the screen, you know, image level. So that fast motion, it doesn't matter if it's like a slideshow flipping through JPEGs really fast. It doesn't matter if it's a flash image, an animated GIF, any kind of media that they can't encode on their, that they can't redirect on their own. They'll actually send an H.264 stream down. And then they can break up. I've got a picture in the article of all these little sections. They can break up a screen into as many little sections as they need. And these sections are dynamically changing. So they might see one thing as an image and send it down as a lossy JPEG. And then all of a sudden it starts moving and they immediately build an H.264 encoding stream and start sending that down.
Where's that done at? Is that done GPU or is that, do you need a encoder or something?
That's
or?
Another awesome thing about Remote FX for Windows 8 is that all of this, this feature and actually all features for Remote FX in Windows 8 are not based on having a GPU or not, or they're not based on being virtual or not.
So that's badass. So that's also like PC over IP a little bit then, where you can do it in software, you can do it in hardware, you still get the same feature set.
Yeah, exactly. And because in Windows 7, it was tough because Windows 7, you had to have a physical GPU And you would get, you had a, like only some features would work on Windows 7 in a VM, but they wouldn't work as Windows 7 native, and it was just really kludgy. So now,
I've got an ATI like $600 graphics card that I'm going to put on eBay then.
Yeah, because once it so it doesn't matter if you're physical or virtual, it doesn't matter if you've got a GPU or no GPU. So because they can, they, if you have a physical GPU, they can virtualize it and slice it up. They can make a, or they can just do it all in software. And what's cool, part of these adaptive graphics also is they actually look at the network. They look at like how much bandwidth and latency and what the round trip is looking like. And they'll actually, and they'll look at the device capabilities in the client and they'll actually tune what they're doing. So for example, doing this H.264 encoding on the host might take more host side processing, but takes less client side decoding, or might actually, maybe they can do that and have better, you know, performance over like network, like slower networks or whatever. Or if they're dropping a lot of packets, like the H.264 protocol itself can handle packet loss. So, or the codec itself can handle like lost bits, you know? So they might recognize that they'll do more in H.264 if they're having a lot of traffic, a lot of packets lost. But they do all that dynamically. So they can actually make decisions to say, and you can override all this with group policy if you want to, but they'll actually make decisions that are like, okay, this client's really shitty, the network's really shitty, so I'm going to go ahead and use some more resources on my host to provide a better experience to this client. And it's exactly how they're encoding, what they're encoding is going to be different and dynamically chosen.
But the protocol changes then too, right? Because now you can also do UDP?
Yeah, and then that's part, right. So and that's part of this too. And they use UDP like the same way that Citrix uses UDP. So before RDP and RemoteFX was TCP only, and now TCP is still like the default and it'll like, you know, fall back to TCP, but what they can, they don't do this with every virtual channel, but with some virtual channels, if they can establish a UDP connection, which they can also do through the remote TS gateway or remote desktop gateway. So if they can establish UDP down to the client, then they'll send certain things like the H.264 and the video streaming and the audio and stuff like that. They'll do that via UDP. But it's not like UDP is replacing TCP. They always have a TCP connection. They'll open a side channel on UDP if they can. But if they can't open that side channel on UDP, it's no problem. They'll continue to do it all on TCP.
So I wonder now, like, I'm curious to hear what Teradici and VMware say about that, just from, because it sounds to me like you can maybe get the best of both worlds then.
You can.
Now, I guess you still screw up the UDP stuff if you run it through a VPN and encapsulate it. You still lose that benefit. But,
right. But what they're doing, it's like the same way that Ericom does it, where they're not trying to, they're actually trying to make the UDP connection all the way through. And if it fails, it falls back to TCP. With PC over IP, there's no fallback. Well, I guess you can fall back to RDP, but that's like falling all the way back. and so here, like, it's the one connection. It's not like you have to disconnect and then try and reconnect with a different client or whatever. So that's kind of cool.
But then they got WAN support now too, right? Like that, the WAN support thing is, I mean, all of this stuff is amazing, but it doesn't really mean a whole lot to me unless I can also use it over the WAN. Cause if RemoteFX is going to become the default protocol, I need to be able to use that.
Yeah, and again, it's like RemoteFX, like it's like they're sort of renaming, like all these are sort of capabilities of RDP, and everything that got better got a RemoteFX stamp. So, because remember, RemoteFX was never a new protocol to begin with; it was just like additional capabilities for RDP.
It was like codec or whatever, right?
Yeah, and like some virtual channels, and so it. So they didn't do anything like specifically for the WAN, apart from everything I just mentioned, like being sensitive to the network, being sensitive to the latency, having this adaptive graphics and doing different things in different parts of the screen, being able to fall back to TCP if they needed to. All of these together combined to make it more WAN friendly, especially things like using the H.264. I mean, just the fact that they can tune the quality of that and tune the frame rates and everything. So before they're trying to send every screenshot down and it was just getting behind and tearing. That's the demos they showed where they did like literally 90% less bandwidth, where they had 30 to 50 megabits of bandwidth being cut down to 3 to 5 megabits. But the reason they did that is because they were encoding to H.264 and then sending that H.264 stream down. And as you know, a 3 to 5 megabit per second, you know, bit rate H.264 stream is going to look damn good.
You know what I can't wait for is Windows Media Center. And if they can do extenders using RemoteFX and this, like, I mean, that would be incredible around your house.
Yeah, yeah. But then you need to buy
the way it
Microsoft
works right
products.
Now is like if you have a DivX movie or something like that, the way that works is it actually sends that down to outside of the out of band and sends that down to like your Xbox as a media center extender, and the Xbox actually renders that. But the Xbox implementation of that codec kind of sucks, so not everything works. And so if you've rendered your own movies or something and the Xbox can't decode that, you're screwed. But the, so you have way more options in Windows. So if you can just remote everything, keep execute it all on Windows, and then and then remote it to you via an awesome protocol, that would rock.
Yeah. For those people who are still buying Microsoft products, yes.
Yeah.
And then the other thing too is like they also showed off, and I wrote an article about this for Consumerized IT. They also showed off a Metro style remote desktop app. And so this is like basically the remote desktop client, like the TSS or the MSTSC. There now is a remote, there's now a Metro version. So it's basically like now there's two versions of the Microsoft RDP client software, like the old style version for laptops and the Metro version for touch. But ironically, of course, I mean, if you, you might have your awesome Metro client, but you're still connecting back to an old school desktop. So yeah, like the actual launcher to launch my connection is all awesome and multi-touch Metro-y, but then I connect back to a dumb, boring desktop behind it. but what they did mention, though, is the features are the same for both the Metro client and the traditional client. All these features, all the additions, all the capabilities, the code beneath them is identical, including multi-touch support. So now they are doing full multi-touch remoting, and with this is like real multi-touch, so not only just multiple points of touch, but also pressure. So that they
you mean the code is identical.
I mean the code, like the actual capabilities. When they write it, they like compiled it for Metro and compiled it for not Metro. And I'm sure like they wrote like the, you know, obviously they had to, like write the different UI, but like the actual like all the DLLs, the play, like all that kind of stuff. So
I'm just curious about how like the ARM implementation.
Well, I'm not talking about ARM
and things like that, but yeah. So if you're just talking about, well, you mentioned tablet clients,
right? But that's like they have x86. I'm talking about Metro. So like they have not specifically mentioned ARM as a client, but I would imagine that if they're making a Metro x86 client, they make a Metro ARM client. And they can still write their same stuff and just, you know, I mean, they might have to do some work. But the point is, everything they implemented, the features are exactly identical across both.
Right. Okay.
But the multi-touch remoting, so multi-touch remoting too. So if you have a traditional tablet, slate PCs now, I guess they're called, and it's got multi-touch and you're remoting to, like, you don't have to have the Metro client to remote multi-touch, but the multi-touch, they're actually remoting multi-touch as a separate input point. So it's not mouse emulation. It is, you know, 10 fingers at once and with multiple pressure, and they can remote all that in. So if you are connecting, like they demoed a Metro tablet connecting to a remote desktop that itself was running Metro, like with Metro IE on the back end, then it will be full remoted like VDI IE and feel like a nice, good Metro experience, even though that part's being remoted. So that looks really cool. I mean, like, you know, and obviously the same limitations they're going to have are the limitations that, so it does look awesome, but you know, of course, Citrix, it's not like this is killing Citrix though, because they're still going to have the limitations of like, you know, it's only going to be like, they're going to probably have their clients that they're on thin clients and, you know, Windows clients only. And then Citrix is going to have to develop the like good Android client and the Mac client and iOS and all that kind of stuff. So, it's typical Microsoft stuff, but the default, what's nice though, is it raises the bar for everyone. So even though it may not be something that, like we all run out and remote replace.
I mean, you know. Well, picture Hyper-V3 now. So Hyper-V3 comes out and Microsoft, I mean, there's a lot of buzz about this, that Microsoft's virtualization platform is going to be the real deal at that point. You know, what the old saying is that, you know, Microsoft's V3 products are usually spot on.
Keep on adding one to that, like every few years.
Yeah, right.
it used to be like the .1 release, and then it was a .1, and then it was like the 2.0 releases, and then it was the 3.0.
Now 7.
Yeah. Well, seriously, right, with Windows?
Yeah. So XP was great until we realized that
what
it was.
What version of Office are we on now?
12, I think. So Hyper-V3 coming out. We've got our Hyper-V V3 coming out. We've got Windows 8, you know, coming out too. I mean, that's a pretty potent solution if it all works together and it works the way you're saying it will. I mean, that's...
Except for all the confusion.
I know that you've written about, is this the Citrix killer, the VMware killer, all that kind of stuff. I think you mentioned it in that article. It's...
I didn't say Citrix killer.
Did you? Well, you said the Bearpaw was a Citrix killer.
Yeah, but that was in 2004.
Right? Yeah, but didn't you? You said something to that effect this time around.
I said, Citrix, HGX, and VMware PCRP. RDP and Remote Effects in Windows 8 is awesome.
Remote Effects on Windows 8 looks awesome. Are Citrix and VMware dead?
Did I write that?
Yes, you did.
Where? Wait.
In the summary.
Oh, I'll be damned. Well, so, I only ruffled one person's feathers for that, and
yeah, Citrix, so it's fine. But I mean, it seems like, you know, we've got, I guess we skipped a year, right? Nobody asked that with Windows 2008 because that was Vista Server, right? But we asked it with 2003 R2 or 2003, and now we're asking it with Windows 8 and Server, whatever it's going to be. And I mean, if it ever had a chance, now it does. I still think these guys are still going to be around. I don't think anybody's dead, but wow, way to go, Microsoft. Now we can all focus on other things.
And with that, I got 1 o'clock. I need to head out. So it's 55. It's 5 minutes after our hour. So I say we wrap this thing up. There's a lot of great stuff that we did not talk about, which means we've got plenty to talk about next week.
Yeah.
Which I love this new time. I see only like 5 people showed up instead of 40. So I don't know.
Did we? But when did that article go live? Too, was it?
That was this morning. Should we do it yesterday? Time.
So yeah. So people may have been
No, it was last night. Was it last night? This morning? I don't know.
It doesn't matter. This is the new time. So tell your friends.
So deal with it. you know, hopefully you'll join us next
hopefully
week.
Jack gets to talk next time.
Actually, I think I'm on a plane next time.
Okay, Jack gets to talk a lot.
Okay, yeah. I'll have a lot to talk about.
We're thinking about doing one. Jack and I were talking yesterday about doing a consumerization show, a little half-hour one maybe or something. Uh-huh. So I don't know if we'll start that this week or next or whatever, but it's something we're thinking about doing at least. So
you should
drive field there too. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You don't have to do it.
Oh, yeah. I vote for that.
Great.
All right. Thanks for listening for 3 People That Did, and we'll see you all next week.
Bye-bye.